We have two cases that arise out of the same incident and same issue, so we have a lot of 22 and a half minutes for each side. So we'll try to keep you on that. But our first case is Levy versus American Family Mutual Insurance, 2011 SC355. Is everybody, are both parties ready?
Citizen Levy is ready.
Respondent's ready, Your Honor.
Thank you. So we have 22, each of you have 22 and a half minutes or thereabouts. And the petitioner will have to keep track of your time. Please state your name and who you represent when you start your argument. And lastly, I want to tell you that we're, some of us, not all of us, use iPads where we keep track of the briefs and our notes and can link to Westlaw on the record. So I just want to let you know that so that you don't feel like we're searching and emailing folks. So that, we're ready to go.
May it please the Court, Gregory Chernushin on behalf of the petitioner Susan Levy. My registration number is 12204. With me today, with permission of the Court, is Brad Levine, who is appearing on behalf of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association as amicus. We have agreed to divide our time equally. I'll provide the Court with a brief factual overview, address the petitioner's issues as it relates to this case, and Mr. Levine will address the public policy matters. This claim arises from a motor vehicle crash December 7th, 2004, caused by a negligent, underinsured motorist. And as a result of that crash, Ms. Levy incurred $18,898.23 in medical bills for the treatment of her injuries. The matter went to arbitration on an underinsured motorist claim, petitioner having received permission from American Family to accept the payment from the tortfeasor's liability insurance. Subsequent to the arbitration award of $77,500, American Family asked for a reduction of that award to take into account $18,898.23 was paid under the medical payments provision of the American Family policy. Now, the Court has certified the issue whether or not it is permissible for MedPay benefits to be offset against underinsured motorist benefits in light of CRS 1321.11.6 and what is commonly known as the collateral source rule. I think it's important that the collateral source rule specifically has an exception where it states, except that the verdict shall not be reduced by the amount by which such person, his estate, or his personal representative has been or will be wholly or partially indemnified or compensated by a benefit paid as a result of a contract entered into and paid for by or on behalf of such person. When we think of that exception, I think it's important that we focus on the action of the tortfeasor and the rationale of the legislature as to why it would permit no reduction for benefits paid on behalf of an injured individual when there is a contract to cover that injured.
Chairman, can I sit for a second and ask you, with respect to the record, one of the points in Judge Terry's dissent is that the medical awards between the arbitration and what was paid your client was overlapping. Do we know that, or what is the state of the record? I'm looking at the arbitration award. It just says $25,000.
Yes, the arbiters did conclude that $25,000 was considered medical out of the $77,500. MedPay had paid only $18,800.
Why is there a difference, and what's the...
That we don't know. We didn't do any voir dire on the part of the arbiters. We had submitted an itemization of bills, and I can't answer how the arbiters came to that conclusion.
So is her characterization overlapping? Is that accurate?
I would say that would be correct.
Why wouldn't it be double billing?
Okay. The issue on the double billing is addressed in the context of what an individual can claim against the tortfeasor. Now, the key language in 10.4609.1a, for the protection of a person injured who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators of underinsured motor vehicles because of bodily injury resulting therefrom. Jury instruction 6.1 includes damages for medical bills. If this were a pure tort case against the wrongdoer could not take the benefit of the available MedPay under the exception of the collateral source rule. The American Family contract language, compensatory damages for bodily injury, which an insured person is legally entitled to recover from the owner operator of an uninsured motor vehicle. American Family stands in the shoes of the tortfeasor. And since the statute says you can make a claim for all available damages from the tortfeasor under the uninsured motorist statute, we then take the collateral source exception that there is no credit given for a jury verdict, or in this case an arbitration award, for medical benefits that have been provided by a contract for the benefit of the petitioner in this case, the $18,898.23. And I think Appeals Court Judge Terry, when he talked about the
overlap, it's a female.
Spoke in terms of overlap. She was addressing the case involving the Social Security benefit under Barnett. And given the circumstances that the purpose of the underinsured motorist statute is to replace what should be available from the tortfeasor, it's our belief that there is no double payment under those circumstances. We have two policy provisions under the American Family coverage, MedPay and uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. If we had just a regular tortfeasor, took him to court, won a judgment, tortfeasor doesn't get the benefit of reduction because of the prudence of the MedPay benefit. Similarly, since American Family is standing in the shoes of the tortfeasor, providing that coverage or that insurance that wasn't available from the tortfeasor, we feel the contract exception of the collateral source rule similarly should apply. The legislative history of the collateral source exception, I think, is interesting, and that's addressed in Van Waters when they were talking about the efforts to limit tort reform, limit recoveries, limit amounts of benefits that injured parties could receive, and they drafted the collateral source rule. But when it ultimately went to committee, and the final draft came out, we did have that contract exception, and there was a lot of statements in the legislative history about concerns for double coverage. But the upshot is that if you're going to have a potential for double coverage, the potential should inure to the injured party, not the wrongdoer. Now, I know we have a a step apart, you know, from a direct action against a tortfeasor. But because we have the uninsured, underinsured motorist statute, which broadly states as a matter of state policy that the injured individual can and should receive those damages which they claim, can claim against the underinsured tortfeasor. So that's our position, and we believe that the law does support the entitlement of a petitioner to receive not only the MedPay benefit, but her underinsured motorist benefit, and that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in permitting a reduction for the MedPay paid from the arbitration award for underinsured motorist benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bradley Levine, I appreciate the court permitting me time to address some of the issues. I'd like to follow up on what Chief Justice Fender, what you were asking about the overlap. And I think that's really significant in this case, and I think it's applicable to a lot of these kinds of cases. And that's the following. There's a distinction that this court has drawn, if you look at the language in the Newton case and the Barnett case, between overlapping types of claims and duplicative claims. And that's really very important. And I think that that's the distinction that Judge Terry is trying to draw here, which is that we don't know in this case, for example, the $25,000 amount that was awarded for economic damages here. It's undifferentiated. In other words, what this court pointed out in those cases in Newton Barnett is that when you're making a claim for economic damages, it has a lot of different components to it. It's not just simply the amounts of monies that are being paid for the compensation here for the medical bills that were incurred by Dr. Levy. You're talking about a whole host of other kinds of not of economic damages. There can be future wage loss, past wage loss, future economic damages, and so on. And that's the problem. We're not talking about a dollar-for-dollar type of recovery so that you can just easily say we're going to offset those amounts against the recovery that you might have gotten from the tortfeasor. And so I'd like to maybe turn to a hypothetical here, and this really highlights what Mr. Richardson was saying here. Let's assume for a second that rather than there was a total of $50,000 that was divided among three different individuals who were injured in this particular accident. Let's assume for a minute that instead that the driver here, you only had Dr. Levy was the only person who was injured in this accident, and you had a full amount, $100,000. A policy, in other words, the liability, the tortfeasor had $100,000 that was available, in other words, more than the $77,500 amount that was ultimately awarded by this particular arbitration panel. In that instance, obviously, Dr. Lee would have had to access her uninsured motorist coverage because there was sufficient amount of coverage available from the tortfeasor. In that instance, if you had an American Family, which had paid out $18,000 in bills, came along and said, well, you know, you are not entitled. You know, the question there is whether or not under the statute, whether or not you'd be able to get a set-off for that amount. The answer in that instance would be, of course, no. In other words, what you have here is you've got the tortfeasor who isn't going to be able to get whatever kind of an offset against the amount that they owe, the $7,500 amount, isn't going to be able to get that type of an offset in that circumstance. In this instance, what we have is we have the majority of the Court of Appeals, which has said that American Family is going to be entitled to an offset against the amount that they paid under their MedPay. That is absolutely inconsistent with the notion that this court has articulated consistently in the Barnett case, in the Newton case, and in the Crawl case, and very prominently in the Crawl case, where it says the purpose of UMUIM coverage is to be a substitute. It's in order to give you the compensation that you would have been entitled to had the tortfeasor had sufficient sufficient amounts of coverage under their policy. In other words, it's basically to say you're going to be compensated for the amount of money, and you're paying a premium for that. The insured is paying a premium for that difference. And what they're saying is that you're going to be fully compensated, at least up to the amount of the policy limits of your uninsured motorist coverage. If what you're doing here is that you allow someone in American Family's position to be able to offset this $18,000 amount that they paid out in the med pay, and to do that in addition to the amounts that they have to pay, in other words, to offset it against the recovery, the amount that you're entitled to under that UMUM coverage, what you're doing is that you are not giving that full compensation that you would be able to achieve, that you'd be able to get if, in fact, the tort user was fully insured. That is,
can I just stop you there?
Sure.
Because and ask you to respond to the argument of the other amicus, which is essentially we don't have a tortfeasor here. The whole purpose of this sort of collateral source rule is to make the tortfeasor bear that burden, right? We don't want to reward the tortfeasor, but isn't your argument, I guess, predicated on having a tortfeasor, which we don't have?
Well, it's just a hypothetical, Your Honor.
Okay. I just want you to respond.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I understand that. The answer to that, though, is that it gets back to the whole purpose, the whole rationale for having the uninsured motorist coverage in the first place. In other words, what this court has consistently held is that the purpose is to essentially compensate the injured party up to the limits of the policy. So that even though we don't have a tortfeasor, for all intents and purposes, what the insurance policy is doing is that it's essentially standing in the shoes of the tortfeasor. And there's a very fine distinction, because then if you then look, for example, at that Tenth Circuit case that the majority relied on, and I know that Amicus relies on, and so on. The problem there is that they somehow have transformed it into this uninsured motorist coverage is somehow is standing in shoes, if you will. And I know I've used the word standing in shoes, but essentially that they're identified with the tortfeasor. And it's not. In other words, the difference here is that what's happened is the injured party has paid a premium, an additional premium, in order to obtain that measure of coverage, of protection in the event that the tortfeasor doesn't have adequate insurance that's available to them. But the upshot of it is that what we have to look at is what the purpose of it is. And the ultimate purpose of the insurance, of that uninsured motorist insurance, is to fully compensate you for those kinds of injuries. And so what happens here is that if you allow American Family to be able to deduct for the amounts that it's paid out under its MedPay coverage, what you're doing is that you are diluting the benefit that is fully available to the insurer, that they pay that premium for. And what this court has indicated in the trilogy of cases is that if there's going to be any kind of overpayment, if you will, and I'm not going to use the word double payment because of the issue that I talked about before, is we can identify, and this gets back to what Chief Justice Bennett was asking about, is that we don't know exactly, it's not necessarily a dollar for dollar amount that we're talking about here. But what if you do is that if we're going to err, if you will, on one side or the other, what codification of the collateral source rule and the contract exception, it says that if we're going to err on it, if there's going to be any kind of a windfall here, it's going to be in favor of the insured who has purchased. And that's really key. And that's what, again, this court has talked about in those trilogy of cases, which is that you pay that extra premium so that, this court has talked about the incentive for purchasing this UMUIM coverage, and you are going to say to someone you're not going to be able to access, and we look at the various examples, for example, the example that this court used in the Newton case when it talked about where you had two folks and they both had $30,000 in coverage, UM coverage, but the bills, if you were to reduce the amounts that are available, you basically are saying, okay, fine, both of you get the $15,000 amount that you were paid under, from your, in that case, it had to do with your PIP coverage. What happens, though, is that the insured who had the, you know, the prudence to go out and buy UWIM coverage gets absolutely nothing for their premium dollars. And that's the problem. That's the conundrum. That's what you're creating here. So at the end of the day, if you're going to say if someone is going to get any kind of a, quote, windfall, and I wouldn't suggest that it is a windfall because you're paying premium dollars for it, that should be on the side of the insured who has paid those monies rather than to benefit, in this case, the insurance company, which is supposed to be giving you that replacement dollars in place of the tortfeasor and for the injuries that have been caused.
So then,
yes.
You know, I think you've articulated the policy of for the contract exception. But there's also a competing policy, which you obviously recognize, about double payment. Is there anything that you have to support your position that's by statute other than the three cases, you know, the cases you cited?
Is there anything other than in terms of statute? Well,
is there any other statutory authority you can
point to? Oh, the statute itself. In other words, if we look at the contract exception, if you look at the language in the contract exception itself, it's going to tell you just that. Other than that, if we're looking at 10.4609 and the purpose for under 10.4609, that it talks about the full compensation. And that's obviously what was articulated in the Qual case. I'd like to reserve the rest of our time, please. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen of the court, my name is Johnson. I represent the respondent. And I'm afraid that as the days have passed, I've become more relying on notes. The $25,000 figure for Ms. Levy's meds was puzzling to me at the time also. The evidence that was introduced was less than that. And then I remember that there was something about some of the expert witness fees being introduced as medical expenses, and that could be the confusion. But it makes no never mind. The deduction was not taken for $25,000. It was taken for the amount that was paid, $18,300 or $800.
Which were entirely meds?
That were paid by... under the medical payments cover. Yes, sir.
Right.
And on the other case, well, are we talking about the other case now? Well, on the other case,
you certainly are free to say whatever you want in your allotted time.
Well, they actually paid $25,000 on the other case. So that was the set off for that.
And were those meds or are they additional economic damages?
Medical pay payments.
Okay.
And we agreed, because we were having to fight about that before the arbitration, and we agreed that we'll do that, we'll decide that issue in front of the judge. And I think the briefs are replete with those numbers from both sides. So that's what happened. The arbiters found this amount of medical expenses, and I don't even think they knew there was MedPay coverage. But we agreed we were going to fight about the MedPay coverage later, which we did. Our position here is that the collateral source rule, which is what you brought us here to talk about, is just not applicable. The uninsured motorist statute places the insurer in the shoes of the tortfeasor. Only for sums the insured is legally entitled to recover. And the right to recover the medical expenses was never in the insured. There's a provision cited, the subrogation rights, our recovery rights. If we pay under this policy, we are entitled to all the rights of recovery of the person to whom payment was made against another. And that's the way it was from the beginning.
I'm totally confused about this because it seems like there's been premiums paid for two set of coverages, and I think that's what Mr. Levine was saying. So I'm a little bit concerned that the insurance company is really denying part of the coverage, which is to pay independently the meds and then cover the uninsured motorist if that's triggered.
Yes, sir. Well, Justice Hobbs, there were two premiums paid, I'm sure, two elements of the premium. But the premium for uninsured motorist coverage is calculated based on underwriting, which takes into account subrogation, how much they collect on that.
And it's very clear under the subrogation clause, if meds are paid off, it can be deducted from the uninsured motorist payments? Explain that to me.
The insurance company retains all right to recover to the extent of payment made under the policy. In other words, this clause says that if we pay, we have the right, and it's a subrogation clause. The insured is a subrogor, and the insurance company is a subrogee. And they have the right to exercise that right. They stand in the shoes of the insured for purposes of collecting the...
And that collection is against the uninsured motorist policy?
Hopefully. But in this particular case...
Both of which are issued by the same company.
No, they would be, would not be, it would be collectible against the tortfeasor.
Okay.
And in this particular case, the tortfeasor was, the insurance company waived its right to subrogation and canceled that right to collect in the settlement with the tortfeasor that produced money for the plaintiff and none for the insurance company. I don't expect to hear a lot of tears, but that's what they did. And this court has issued a decision fairly recently, Feral Gas. I think I endorsed it as a supplemental endorsement. And that case says that in a subrogee, subrogor situation, where the insurance company is standing in the shoes of the insured, the insurance company can do what it wants with that interest. If you recall in that case, it was a $200,000+ interest.
You're right, Feral Gas, but that was a different, that wasn't dealing with policies, that the policies underlying UM and UIM insurance.
That's correct, Judge, but Your Honor, that is correct. However, the principle that the insured is bound by that settlement is the reason I cite that case. It is not on all fours, but the insured is bound by that. That right to recover the medical expenses is extinguished. And I think that's significant because what that does is it turns this into just a contract case. It's a contractual provision. They have the right to that. And they don't have to pay twice.
Well, if you look at it from a contract point of view, one of the things I find confusing is a question I asked the petitioners is, how do you know what in an arbitration proceeding exactly what the medical payments were, you know, when they award it, make an award? How do you know specifically?
Well,
and I think the short answer is, as Mr. Levin points out in the amicus brief, you don't.
I'm sorry?
You don't know. You can't really know. You might know what was presented, but you don't know what was the arbitrator's mind and when they came up with the figure.
I do, Judge. Your Honor, I keep saying
You can call me Your Honor or Judge, that's fine. I'm used to being called lots of names, sorry.
But told us.
They said medical payments, $25,000.
That's right.
And what does that mean?
It means that they included $25,000 in medical expenses.
All right. For what medical payments? Are they the specific ones that your client paid? Sure, the answer is you don't know.
No, I do know. $18,838.
Well, you want to argue that. But I think that the point is that the arbitrators can pretty much do whatever they want and award whatever they want, just like a jury, right? So it's very difficult. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Johnson?
No.
I know you wouldn't agree about that.
No.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
No, justice. I wouldn't.
And Chief Justice, but it's me.
We lawyers get up in the morning and the sun is in the sky and God's earth is working right, and we start talking and all of a sudden it's all mixed up. There's no, I don't see the.
I saw Galileo straighten that out.
Well, before you move away, could I ask you about the waiver? Explain about the waiver again and why that apparently is not significant here. You waived your right to recover from the tort feasor with regard to the initial settlement, is that right?
Yes, but with regard to the, yeah, yes. And the reason for that is that insurance companies do that all the time on these cases. If they don't think they can collect it, and the insured, that letter also grants the insured permission to settle. And they do that because the other side, the other insurance company, is not going to give the money unless they have a full release of their insured. If they give them the $50,000 and leave a claim against the insured out there, it's what we call bad faith. And that's why that's done.
So with regard to the settlement with the tortfeasor, you had no right of subrogation, no right to recover anything that was paid to your insured by the tortfeasor, is that right?
Yes.
And then, so then though, but with regard to the UIM coverage, conceptually, I guess what's I'm having trouble getting a handle on here is it seems that what you're saying is you are entitled, however, to recover that amount that you paid, that was paid with regard to medical.
Well, Justice Coates, that's what they claim. But in actuality, we're saying we don't have to pay it twice.
And is there something in the contract or the language of the statute that would say you don't have to pay it twice?
No. Well, the contract calls for us to pay it once, and we paid it once.
Why is that? It seemed like the contract actually has two different provisions for you to pay for it. And you're saying surely only one of those should control, I guess. But if you don't have a right to recover back from the tortfeasor with regard to medical payments, then I'm having trouble seeing why that. I mean, I could see policy-wise, and we can talk, and you both make different policy arguments here, but with regard to the provisions of the contract itself, your coverage that they paid for, I'm looking for something more specific that would indicate why you shouldn't have to pay twice, or in effect, why you should be able to recover for having paid for one of those two times.
Well, Justice Coates, I disagree with the being repaid. It is not being repaid. We're just talking about not paying it again, and also complying with our obligations under the underinsured motorist statute, which is to ensure that Ms. Levy is fully compensated for her injuries. And she was in this case. The injuries found by the arbiters were $77,500 or something like that, and she got every penny of it. They're now saying they want more. They are attempting to use the collateral source statute to create a windfall that wasn't there. Now, in this particular case, the gross award was less than the policy limits. Had it been more than the policy limits, the results would have had to be different because there probably would have been no offset.
See, I guess part of, and I'm having trouble expressing exactly what my confusion is here, but it seems to me you both are relying on the collateral source rule to some extent, the statute here. You may be more in terms of policy that there shouldn't be, that the insured shouldn't get to recover twice. But let's assume you're right, and the collateral source rule has nothing to do with this and doesn't apply. Why aren't you just bound as a matter of contract to pay the two things you were paid to insure for? And if you don't have a right to recover on one of them, what's the argument for why you should only have to pay once?
Well, Judge, this company did pay both of them. They paid all of the medical expenses, $18,000 and some dollars. They paid the remaining cash that was due. 34,000 something. And what we're here about is not an element of damages of the plaintiff, but whether she can get two dips. Now, you know,
two dips for two premiums.
Pardon?
Two dips for two premiums. You can get more insurance, right? I mean, that's, you wouldn't fight that, right? Represent the company. I mean, you know.
Had she had higher limits, paid big more premiums, it wouldn't have made any difference to her damages. And she got, there's a case, a Court of Appeals case, De Herrera, that talks about this very issue, premiums. And premiums are based on the situation. And one of the situations that they're based on is we don't pay the same damages twice. The fact that she could have got those damages had she not had MedPay under UM. As a matter of fact, she got some extra medical damages over and above what had been paid. They said $25,000, and her expenses were $18,000 that we knew of. But American Family is not a tortfeasor, and the purpose of the, I mean, you brought us here to talk about the collateral source rule. And the purpose of that is to protect against a tortfeasor taking advantage. Now, as I indicated earlier, the uninsured motorist carrier replaces a tortfeasor with respect to compensatory damages, which the insured is legally entitled to recover, but not punitive or exemplary damages. In the Gardner-Schwartz case, y'all held that there is an element of exemplary and punitive in the collateral source rule, that it is designed, or it performs in part to punish the tortfeasor in addition to keeping him from benefiting. And to the extent that the collateral source rule is punitive, is not covered by underinsured motorist coverage. And that's in the UM statute. It says it covers compensatory damages and specifically says, but not exemplary damages. That's an element of distinction, which does make a difference in this case. I'd just say the cases relied on by the petitioner, the three UM cases, are UM cases dealing with insurance policy provisions that tended to reduce coverage available or damages payable to the insured. They have no bearing on the collateral source doctrine, and frankly, they have no bearing on this case. No coverages were reduced, and no benefits were reduced.
Jensen, can I ask you a question?
Please.
From point of view of statutory construction, just for a second, focusing on the statute itself, what's your statutory argument to support the concept, other than the policy of double dipping? What's your argument from a statutory construction perspective as to why the collateral estoppel rule doesn't apply?
Collateral estoppel?
I'm sorry. Not collateral estoppel. Collateral source. I apologize.
It doesn't apply because
statutorily, not for a policy reason. What's your argument from looking at a statutory construction?
There is no reduction in the damages. That's number one. Number two, the bills were paid. It's not like they're trying to take something away from the plaintiff. That, and then, of course, as you mentioned, I think the panel's award in this case was specific. I don't know if I answered your question. Did I give you anything that sounded like an answer?
I refuse to comment.
It
seems to me we're you know, the question that you're right, the question that we are interested in is to what extent does the collateral source doctrine cover this situation? And it's a statutory question.
Well, if you take that last sentence, I think you pervert the intent of, or deflect the intent is probably a better word, of the statute. The insured got everything she paid for. And that statute is not intended. The purpose of that statute from statutory construction is to prevent double recovery. That's the reason it was enacted. And there are occasions when it creates double recovery, but its primary purpose was to prevent it. And I don't think it should be construed. I'm going back to a long way for statutory construction. To act contrary to its intent. This case is on all fours with Quinones, and the logic and reasoning in that case is clear. The panel's award in this case was specific and clear. And our position is that these facts are not subject to the collateral source rule, that they are contractual, that by waiving and discharging the medical pay claim, it ceased to exist. And this was before the arbitration, and it's not really a reduction in the award. It's simply a recognition that the plaintiff had no right to recover those amounts. As I said, I don't think the panel even knew that there was a MedPay policy. We sure didn't tell them. Well, that's our position, and I'd ask that you hold that way.
Well, counsel, can I just, before you sit down, let me just follow up on Justice Coates' questions. I mean, I guess your position is that the collateral source doctrine is not even implicated here, correct? We don't even get into the collateral source doctrine, or are you trying to, you can't have it both ways. It either doesn't apply or its policy supports you. So that, I guess I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, can you come to that? Appellate court, you have to have it both ways.
Okay. Well, which way would you prefer it to be?
Well, it was.
Okay.
Because she didn't have a right to recover those. We had the panel do it that way. We specifically asked them find the amount of medical expenses so that we could work this problem out afterwards. Does that answer your question?
Well, maybe you can help me. Let's just set the collateral source doctrine aside then, and tell me what was she entitled to, in your view, under the contract? What does the contractual language require you to pay?
The amount under the UM portion of the contract? The amount?
Well, either or both. I mean...
Well, in the UM portion, she was entitled to recover whatever compensable damages exceeded the amount of coverage available from the tortfeasor, and that would include economic damages, pain and suffering, that sort of thing. And that was $77,500 less the amount that they had previously paid for the medical insurance.
And it's the intersection between the medical and the uninsured motorist I'm trying to figure out, which is, I think, Justice Coates' question. Can you help me understand that? What were you required to pay under both of those categories?
Well, there were two coverages. One required payment of medical expenses up to $25,000 with a subrogation provision. And the other was the underinsured motorist coverage, which covered compensatory damages in amount between the top of the tortfeasor's insurance policy and the policy limits.
Mr. Johnson, let me ask you a question. I see your time's about up, but as I take it, what you're really saying to us is that the collateral source exception, the contract exception in the statute, doesn't apply because the insurance company the underinsured, the insurance company does not step in the shoes of the tortfeasor for the purpose of that statute. Isn't that really what you're arguing? The exception clause, it doesn't count here. The contract exception clause, for all the reasons you've given, that to me seems like what you're really arguing.
Well, I don't. Yes, I mean, that is a way to put it. I don't think, in a more general term, that it's appropriate to make the collateral source pay twice.
Well, okay, but the statute clearly gives us a contract exception. The legislature's told us that. So we have to look at those kind of words, and the only thing I can come up with is that it doesn't apply, because for this purpose and this of this kind of insurance, you don't step into the shoes of the tortfeasor. For whatever, I mean, double dipping or other?
Yes.
Thank you. Buttle?
I guess we get to go again.
Okay, well, we'll continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's where I want to start out, which is the language of the statute is absolutely clear, and specifically the contract exception is absolutely clear. And that contract exception describes exactly what we have here, which is we have, it says that you shall not be reduced by the amount by which the person has been or will be wholly or partially indemnified or compensated by benefit paid as a result of a contract entered into and paid for by or on behalf of such person. That it describes exactly what happens when you have this MedPay coverage, and you cannot reduce it. That's what the legislature has said in passing the statute. There isn't any type of an exception for it under the kinds of circumstances Mr. Johnson's talking about. As far as I wrote down some of the words that Mr. Johnson used here. He says, well, Levy won't have to pay again. He says that Dr. Levy has been, quote, fully compensated, that she got everything that she paid for. We don't know that. That's the problem here. It gets back to what you were asking about, Justice Ide, which is that what we have here is we've got an amount of monies that are payable when you make a claim for benefits because of an accident. You're talking about a whole panoply of types of damages. Here, all we know is that there was $18,000 in medical bills that were incurred for the past amounts. And yet, at the same time, we've got an award which encompassed a whole range of other kinds of damages. We don't know, and there's no way, as Mr. Johnson acknowledged, because the arbitrators don't differentiate. And so the upshot of it is that to say that she got everything she paid for and to say that there isn't a reduction, she says there hasn't been he says there hasn't been any kind of reduction in the coverage. And the answer is absolutely there's been a reduction. That's exactly the concern that was evinced by this court in all three of those cases, in the Newton, Barnett, and Carl cases, which is that you are reducing. It's no different than reducing the amounts that you get under your PIP coverage when we had the PIP laws in force in the state. It's no different than getting the disability benefits taken out. It's exactly the same thing. What you're doing is you're taking these MedPay amounts and reducing the amount that the injured party is entitled to. And as this court said in the Crawl case, you're not allowing the injured party to get fully compensated as they're entitled to. Yes, Justice Rice.
Yeah, thanks. Mr. Levine, that's easy to see when the coverage amount is over what would be covered by the original policy, and you'd have to dip into the supplemental policy. It's harder here, obviously.
Yes.
And I think that's what the Chief and others have been really struggling with is, how do we write an opinion that helps us figure out what exactly this compensation is when we are within the policy, and yet there's a supplemental insurance, and we're not dipping into that extra policy. How can you help us figure that out?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, Your Honor, I think in terms of writing an opinion that's going to encompass this is basically to say, look, when you have a provision, when what you're talking about here is that you've got an offset type of provision like this, that the upshot of it is that you're not going to be able to enforce it, that it's against the public policy in the state. It's no different than anything else. That and it really does get back to what Justice Hobbs' concern was, and it has to do with when you really are paying for extra, you're paying an extra premium. I mean that's what this court even said.
Sure, and if you were,
you're paying an extra premium for it, and you need to get something for it. And to simply say, because there's a record that I'm aware of that says, yes,
just what I'd like to do is, since the same parties, it's a different case. Just call a different case and we'll go ahead with your answer. If that's all right with you.
That's fine, Your Honor.
All right.